Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here's your host, Sean Graham.
Thank you, Adam. Welcome to the History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham coming at you today, nearly live. We are in Ottawa, Ontario. The Canadian Historical Association annual meeting is over, but Congress is still going on, so we're still doing shows from Congress 2015. Again, one of the many benefits of having Congress be a home game for me is that I can be here for the whole thing because I live 5 minutes away from campus. So it's really easy for me to be here, which is good because we have a really interesting topic to talk about today with Susan Jodry from St. Mary's University. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. This is like the CHA after party.
Right. This is when the cool kids come out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you study Calgary Stampede.
Yes.
This is what your PhD dissertation was on, the Stampede, and what you presented this week as part of the CHA was a paper entitled Captive Audience, the 1923 Raid on Calgary City Hall.
That's right.
Now, before we get into the Stampede stuff, we were just talking before, you're from Nova Scotia.
I am.
Work in Nova Scotia.
Yes.
Study Calgary.
Yes.
How does this happen?
I find that with historians, they either gravitate towards things that resonate with them because they're from a geographic location, or they study something as a curiosity and an anomaly. And in my case, it was kind of the curiosity aspect of it. So when I was doing a BA in anthropology and learning about Buffalo Bill's Wild West Show and how he would take First Nations performers, mostly from the States, but also some from Canada, over to Europe and paraded them around in front of audiences, I was like, Canada has a very large First Nations population. We must have done something similar. And the similarity is the Calgary Stampede.
So that was your initial entry point.
It was.
But what about the methodology then, and just the logistical difficulty of studying the Calgary Stampede in Nova Scotia? I mean, is that a challenge in terms of finding your sources? Because I would imagine a lot of stuff is in Calgary.
It is. And I spent entire summer just going to the Glenbow Archives, and the Stampede actually has their own archives, and I was fortunate enough, I hit like this golden summer where they had a summer student, who, Ryan, he was fantastic, and he basically gave me free rein. So I was able to go through and just spend all summer in the archives, which is everybody's dream.
It really is. And if listeners think she's being sarcastic, she's not. Like,
no, that's
actually real.
Yeah.
That is a dream of ours.
There's a reason why historians probably won't have skin cancer.
Right. Except for us redheaded.
Right.
Us redheaded folks.
Exactly.
But, you know, because even when you're sitting next to the window, you sort of could feel it. Yeah.
That's true.
It's
the
little
burn.
Dangerous.
Yeah.
It's a little dangerous. So,
absolutely.
So, you're studying the Stampede, but it's not the Stampede as a whole. You're studying First Nations representations.
That's right. And that's a really good distinction because often when I talk about, it's representations of First Nations people, everyone's like, oh, you study the rodeo. And I actually have done very little with the rodeo. Mary Ellen Calm has written a fantastic book where she does look at rodeos and First Nations participation in those rodeos. But I look at all the other performance stuff, where there were certain expectations placed on First Nations men and women in terms of how Aboriginality was actually represented and performed.
Yeah. I know for me personally, when I think of those sorts of things, you think of things like the Indian days and Banff and those sorts of displays. And sure, there's an awareness that there's First Nations participation in Stampede, but you don't think of them, or don't think of it as them necessarily being put on display by the organizers in the same way as these other events that are specifically designed for tourists to come view First Nations people.
For sure. And the one thing that surprised me when I was doing kind of the overall project was I spent way more time off the Stampede site than actually on the Stampede site. So there were lots of events in the downtown core. Of course, lots of the ephemera depicted First Nations men in particular in certain ways. But there is an Indian village on the Stampede site that is still called the Indian Village. And it was problematic in some ways because visitors were kind of used to ethnographic displays.
Right.
So it really wasn't supposed to be an ethnographic display, but many non-Aboriginal visitors didn't know how to interact with the space. So often organizers would have to remind people that this is where people live.
right.
for the duration of the stampede. Mm-hmm. So please don't just wander into their homes. Like, give them the courtesy at least stating your presence before you just enter where they live.
This notion of First Nations tourism is really fascinating.
It is,
That fascination that people had and continue to have with it, because it's a thing that continues to exist.
Oh, totally.
So overall, your dissertation was looking at, you know, the bulk of the 20th century, but what you're looking at this week was specifically to 1923.
That's right.
So what happened in 1923? The title is Raid on Calgary City Hall.
That's right.
And I Googled 1923 Raid on Calgary City Hall and was able to find very little on this. So once you told me exactly what it was about, I was stunned.
Right.
So give the people a treat.
Absolutely.
And tell this story.
So before I tell the story, one thing that I love actually about, I'm sort of horrified but also intrigued, is that I expected that there would be change over time in the 20th century when I looked at representations of First Nations people at the Calgary Stampede. And what I actually found was a consistency in terms of expectations in the performance, that First Nations people were often exoticized. They were representing the past for white settlers. And so in this instance, the raid, the 1923 raid on City Hall, it seems kind of like a unique blip, but it's actually a focal point in some ways of overall attitudes towards First Nations people and land and urbanization.
Okay, so it's more representative of a whole mentality towards First Nations people than it is an anomaly.
Absolutely, exactly. So the Stampede always, and still does, have opening day parade. The other way that First Nations people have participated in the kind of off-site events is through judging street displays, or being judged actually as street displays throughout the 20th century. But in 1923, there had been a stampede in 1912, which was attached to the agricultural exhibition, and as it was for many years. But in 1912, Guy Wiedek, who was a vaudeville performer from the States, had been in Calgary in 1908 and was like, this would be a great place to have a Frontier Day celebration. So they do it in 1912. They do it again in 1919 after the First World War. And then in 1923, they really kind of start in earnest with what we now consider the Stampede. Mm-hmm. So in order to kind of kick off this 1923, this is going to be an annual event, they decide it would be an excellent idea to ask some First Nations men if they would participate in a publicity stunt, which was a raid on City Hall. And the City Hall was in right downtown. It had been newly opened in 1911, so it definitely was a representation of civilization and progress and modernity and all those things that encapsulates. So what happened was, these First Nations men, they paraded down the streets in the downtown core up to the steps of City Hall, got Mayor George Webster, who is known as the Cowboy Mayor, so they are playing cowboys and Indians quite literally, tied him up, put him on the back of a horse, and then paraded him through town. Yeah.
Did people know, like, what was going on? Did they announce that this was going to happen?
There weren't any kind of newspaper, like, come out and see this raid. So, prior to the day that it happened.
Right.
So, I suspect that some people did know, because the first act of, they installed one of the First Nations chiefs as the new mayor, and the first act of this new mayor was to shut down all the traffic on the street, which is also an interesting, like, the first thing that the First Nations mayor did was stop modernity, basically.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Which is also a really interesting parallel.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
So there had to have been some sort of warning, I suspect, because that stopped the streetcars, it stopped traffic right in the downtown core. And according to newspaper reports, the streets basically flooded with spectators at that point. So there had to be quite a sizable crowd. Mm-hmm. And something else that the newspapers point out is that it seemed like everyone was taking photos, that pictures were, like, everybody had a camera, which again is like this contrast between modernity and the First Nations raid on City Hall. So that dichotomy.
So there's a lot of issues to unpack with this. you mentioned that there were some children around who were visibly upset at what was going on. So it's almost like professional wrestling, in which you know the adults are there understanding what this actually is, whereas the kids don't.
Well, and it's all interpreted through a newspaper reporter. So whether that actually happened. So in the newspaper accounts, children are represented as being very excited that this is happening, that they're actually seeing the Wild West come to life on the streets of their city. So according to newspaper reports, again, which may or may not be true, young boys were like, oh, they're going to tie him to a stake, scalp him, and light a fire under his feet.
Right.
So sort of those images from dime novels or Hollywood Wild West shows that is a very, I think, different experience in the United States than maybe it was in Canada. Mm-hmm.
But, of course, there has to be this awareness that, of course, it's not real. I mean, if a group of people went to City Hall and tied up the mayor, you figured the police would probably shoot them or something.
Like, that's right.
That's not actually going to be able to happen.
That's right. And the way I kind of read this exercise was through comedy.
Right.
And Philip DeLoria, who is a scholar in the States, he talks about Indians in unexpected places, that non-First Nations people expect First Nations people to reside in certain spaces and not to reside in other spaces.
Right.
So he uses an example of a First Nations woman at a beauty salon sitting under like a dryer. Of course, her hair is in braids. So people look at that image and they laugh. And it is meant to be funny, and the humor there, it's unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
So in the same way, the idea of installing a First Nations man as mayor would have been very humorous to a non-Aboriginal population in 1923, where the Treaty 7 was signed in 1877, and that's kind of when the reserve system in that area took place.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this idea, well, First Nations people are actually subdued, so this is really funny because this doesn't happen anymore.
Right, this would never happen.
That's right.
Like, it's so beyond...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, First Nations people's couldn't even vote unless they gave up their treaty rights until, like, 1960. So in 1923, it's like, it would be impossible for these people to participate in this sort of political process, even to become mayor.
Right.
Yeah.
But then I guess sort of the question would be, I mean, what the participants of it, the First Nations participants, what did they get out of it? Why are they doing it? And because you would think that if they're complicit to a certain degree in this almost mocking of themselves, what benefit do they derive from this? Why are they doing this? Their active participation in something that can be seen as demeaning or negative.
Mm-hmm.
Now, granted, that's through a 2015 lens that I view it.
Yeah.
But what is their motivation?
That's a great question. When you look at it in terms of the broader aspects of performance of the Stampede, when the Calgary Stampede occurs, it actually allows members from all of the Treaty 7 nations to get together, reside in the Indian village, or maybe be part of the rodeo or be part of the parade. So it allows them to communicate with each other in a way that usually they're quite separate.
Right.
And of course, they during that time period in particular would have to get the okay from Indian agents. And even in 1912, it was very political whether or not First Nations people would be allowed to participate.
Right.
So in some ways, not only is it an act of agency, but it's also an act of resistance.
Right.
They've been saying, well, this gives us an opportunity to meet together off the reserve. There were prizes given out. Of course, all the judges were white men,
sure.
Who either had background as, you know, Indian agents or the guy at the local hardware store, because on the Soutina Reserve is right on the Calgary border.
Okay.
And so there was First Nations people in the city of Calgary all the time. And so they even had the hardware store guy participate because lots of First Nations people went to the hardware store. So he had this kind of relationship with them that maybe would have been different from, say, like the Indian agents. But it's this really complex kind of colonial relationship with all these white men and these First Nations participants, where they're actually in contact with each other quite a bit. Mm-hmm. So there's a familiarity and a kind of a willingness to participate.
Right.
And I think over time it's been really incorporated as a point of pride, not to speak for First Nations people, because I am from a settler family, so I look at this very much from kind of a white expectation, colonial perspective.
Right, and certainly there are things that Aaron Boyce, who's been on the show a bunch of times, that I say to him and he says to me, that if somebody else were to say to me, would be considered offensive.
Right.
Right. But because we have a relationship that we can say those things back and forth, like, it's okay.
Right.
And that's fine.
Like, that's right.
You know, we're close enough friends that we can call each other horrible things.
Right, exactly.
And it's fine.
That's what friendship does.
Right. So it's, but if someone were just walking past the room and heard us talking to each other, they might think that we really hated each other.
Absolutely.
Right? So it's, you know, so those sorts of situations are different for the people who are inside them.
Absolutely.
Than looking on the outside.
So even the example of Guy Wiedek again, it seems, anyway, from the things that I've read and the people I've talked to, worked hard to create and maintain that relationship with First Nations performers. Mm-hmm. So there would be times like New Year's Day where people would go on reserve for supper, right? So they were in each other's lives in other ways outside of the stampede, which is also what complicates this kind of narrative, right?
Right, because I would imagine that it's very difficult for you to unpack those relationships.
Big time, yeah. Right. Yeah, absolutely. Especially since most of what I have is sources from white men.
Sure.
And not necessarily a First Nations voice. Although I would love the community to take the work that I've done and say, well, we see this differently, and do something completely different. That would be amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mostly rely on letters between organizers, newspaper accounts, and some Indian agent documents as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you've touched on this as well, this issue of modernity.
Yes.
And the sort of the past, the old representations of First Nations in the modern new city of Calgary.
That's right.
And this is something that's I think still exists to a certain extent, is this view of First Nations people as primitive.
Yep.
So how does that manifest itself in the 1923 raid, apart from, you know, shutting down traffic, and there's symbolism there. Like, is there an awareness, is there a conscious awareness on the part of the participants or in the newspaper accounts that this is what it is?
That's right.
Or is it you looking at it backward, like looking back at it and saying, well, maybe there are these tacit elements that go along with it?
Right. It is extremely overt. So, there's a really simple answer to that. I mean, in the newspapers, they're using language like, the chasm that yawns between the past and the present has been bridged in a single day, and it's been bridged by the presence of First Nations people in the city. So that would be one example. Another example that we were talking about as well was giving motivation for the raid. So in the newspaper, really putting words, I think, in First Nations performers' mouths, that they had come into the urban space to see how the white man had treated the land that they had bestowed upon them.
Right.
And then saying things like they were impressed by the large buildings and the modernness of the city. And because they saw the city, they met the mayor and thought he was a nice guy, they were willing to give the city back to him. because they were doing such a good job with the land,
right?
Yeah, yeah. So also kind of not just giving an explanation for the raid, you know, why First Nations people would be coming into the city in the first place and tying up the mayor, but also justifying using the land in the way that they did in Calgary, mm-hmm. right?
So. Right. Right, and how were they dressed? Like, because I would imagine the dress would speak to this issue as well.
That's right, and they were definitely wearing kind of those markers of Aboriginality headdress. They were on horseback. They were wearing buckskin. So yeah, definitely. And the language, just the language around the past and the present. One woman describes one of the First Nations participants, who's in his 90s, as a bronze statue. So. Oh. Literally kind of an artifact of the past.
Right.
So.
You're right. That is extremely overt.
Yeah.
This. And I guess the other thing that occurs to me is that these newspaper accounts that are written about this, are they written very straightforward and direct, or are they kind of tongue-in-cheek?
I think they're expressing what the majority of the settler population actually thought.
Okay.
And other historians and cultural scholars have looked at parades in terms of adopting the authority of the city, going through the city, adopting that authority to say this is a real narrative.
Right.
That we all legitimize and agree on, and because we're doing this right through kind of the power channel, right?
Yeah.
Then we all agree that this is how it is.
Right.
So thinking about it that way, I think it is less tongue-in-cheek and more, yes, we really believe that there's this vanishing element too. And in other things I have looked at in terms of the stampede, in 1966, they're talking about the Indian village, and the quote is perfect in terms of how the settler population is trying to make sense that First Nations people still exist and have existed through this process of modernization that they have also experienced. And it says, visit the Indian village, step back in time to meet the Indian of today. It's just like, okay, so they're of the past, but now you're trying to make sense of the fact that they're also of the present.
Right.
So they're still wearing this role of being, you know, artifacts of what Calgary used to be. Mm. But, oh, I guess we have, they're still around, right?
Right.
So how do we make sense of that?
Right. That sounds like a Family Guy joke where they're in the Middle East or whatever. Like, yeah, the 80s just got here. Like,
yeah, that's right.
What?
And this is, I mean, I love studying the popular culture stuff in particular because when you look at the stampede and the rhetoric used around First Nations people and the way that First Nations people participate in the stampede, there's a lot of restrictions placed on them, a lot of expectations placed on them that you also see in other colonial kind of bureaucratic, like residential schools or the reserve system. But it shows how those systems actually follow them everywhere.
Right. So, yeah, even in something that's supposed to be fun.
That's right.
Supposed to be a leisure activity.
That's right. It's still regulated. Mm. They're still under surveillance the entire time. So it's almost a replication of these colonial systems, even in something like, the Calgary Stampede.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I guess that leads to then the question of, the execution of this event.
Mm.
And obviously you don't want anyone, regardless of who it is, actually being violent.
No.
Whether it's the First Nations participants themselves or someone who may not understand what's happening, that it's a show.
That's right,
Reacting to this in a violent way. So there definitely needs to be parameters just for that purpose.
For sure.
So was there a script to this? Was there a notification?
Not that I could find.
Okay.
I suspect there probably was some sort of promotion of the event, knowing what I know about Guy Wiedek. One thing he was very good at was promotion. He was actually excellent at it, to the point where with the first stampede, he was getting school children to write letters to their family members who were outside the city to invite them to come to the stampede. Mm. And he is the one who kind of instituted this, everybody in the city should dress up and it's like recreating, and the language that he would use was like, this is a recreation of the real true West.
Right.
So when the 1923 event happens afterwards, when people are talking about it, they're like, oh, the mayor, you know, he was the first one to put on a cowboy hat and a kerchief and cowboy boots and really show the spirit of the stampede. And so the rest of the city kind of followed suit.
Because that speaks to, I mean, for as much as the presentation of the First Nations is a fiction,
right,
so too is the presentation of Calgary in that sense.
That's right.
They're putting something, they're creating something, creating a vision of what they think outsiders think Calgary is or what the West is.
That's right.
So it's not, they're not just doing it with First Nations.
No, absolutely.
So how then does that change the way you look at this event and the way the overall representations of First Nations people? Because it's not just happening in that part of the Stampede. It's the whole event.
Absolutely. And so here is what I think the difference is between the First Nations participation and the cowboy performance. And a number of scholars in the United States have looked at Buffalo Bill's Wild West kind of in the same way, is that often the cowboy performers could go off to their other jobs or
Yeah.
Like at some point they were something else. Whereas First Nations performers, especially with the Calgary Stampede, where they're brought in the city, they live on the Indian village in teepees for the entire week. They never actually get to leave their role. So the difference in terms of the in the minds of the non-Aboriginal population would be, this is how First Nations individuals authentically live all the time. Like, this is their experience. And I think that's the racialized aspect.
Right.
I mean, there's whiteness as well.
Sure.
And that's racialized in certain ways.
Right.
But actually wearing some of these expectations on their bodies is different.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And in addition, there's the film has written about and identified as well.
That's right.
Go along with this as well. But within that context, it does provide an opportunity for some of these First Nations to subvert that image as well, because they're given a place.
Exactly. That's right.
And so have you seen that a lot, that they're actively taking advantage of that opportunity?
Yes. Not in the same way that Paige Raymond talks about in her book Authentic Indians. She has some very good examples of those types of subversions in other contexts. Mm-hmm. But in terms of, one very solid example was, there was a First Nations woman who decided that she would run for the Queen of the Stampede. And she actually ends up winning.
Okay.
Yeah, her name is Evelyn Eagle Speaker, and she's out in BC now, Evelyn Locker. And so she won, and after she won, in the newspapers there was this huge debate over what she should wear. Should she be dressed like the Indian princess, which is how she was positioned through kind of the entire competition?
Right.
Or should she be wearing a cowgirl's outfit? And when I asked her, you know, years later, what did you think about this? And she said, well, the whole thing was kind of funny because I lived on a ranch. So I wore, you know, ranch clothes all the time.
Right.
So it didn't seem strange to me that I would dress like a cowgirl, because that's how I existed in that context.
Right.
But at the same time, the non-Aboriginal population who was writing in, they were writing in saying things like, our First Nations population is declining, she should be able to wear her traditional dress, and the tourists should be able to come and see a real living First Nations person while she still is alive. So there was still this idea of this kind of vanishing. But the other comment that she made, and she made at the time and then again when I asked her about it, was she really saw this as a way of showing kind of the settler population that First Nations people were intelligent and educated, and that they were contributors to the society the same as the non-Aboriginal population was. So she saw that as a way to try and bridge these kind of two different societies.
Mm-hmm. Because you would think that, I mean, for this sort of a thing, that she should be able to wear, like, she shouldn't have to go buy something.
Right,
to fit a role. Like, she should be able to go to her closet and say, this is what I'm going to wear. Like, that would make sense.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the organizers of the event, so the sponsors of the event, were very much like, every single Queen of the Stampede, like, we outfit her in, you know, a new hat and boots, and this is what we will do for her. Right. And so what ended up happening is in the parades, she actually wore her traditional dress that I think her mother had made for her. So it was very meaningful, obviously, that way. But then in some of the other events, she would be wearing, like, a cowgirl's outfit.
Right.
So it was, they did both.
But honestly, I mean, she is a cowgirl. She's also a First Nation. So, I mean, it represents the whole of the person, because people are complicated.
Multiple. Yeah, that's right.
Like, there's a lot, like, there's a lot of things that go into identity.
Absolutely.
So the fact that she was able to not necessarily be pigeonholed one way or the other,
that's
and she could express multiple things, I mean, that's probably a testament to her.
I think so, too. And I sent her drafts of that section. And her comment was, I think you're making more of this than it really was. So I was like, no, this is actually really important.
Right.
Really important, especially exactly what you just said around ideas of identity and what that means.
Mm-hmm.
The other way that I've seen kind of resistance or subversion is that after the Second World War, there were a number of members of the Treaty 7 Nations who were part of the Indian Association of Alberta,
okay,
which is a political organization, and you can almost watch how that involvement kind of ramps up, and the requests they start making of the Stampede organizer ramps up too.
Mm.
So all of a sudden they're rightfully demanding a good washroom space for the village, and demanding laundry space for the village, and demanding that they shouldn't have to live in an area that floods every year. very
reasonable.
Simple things.
Reasonable.
Or, like, they shouldn't have to line up to get rations because that's dehumanizing. So they're starting to make demands of the Stampede in terms of their treatment as other kind of political awareness is starting to spread, which is pretty cool.
Getting back to the 1923 for a second, though, we talk about all these issues that you've mentioned. Can it all be traced back to 23? Because if 23 is the first time that Stampede is an annual event, does this raid and the treatment of First Nations there set a precedent that eventually spawns into all these issues that you're now talking about, this poor treatment of these participants? Can it be traced back to 23?
I think it can be traced even earlier, back to 1912, like the way the first one was set up.
Yeah.
And in terms of when I look at 1923, like I said, it in its execution, it's an anomaly.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't happen again. So they don't do it in 24 or 25 or 26, right? They still continue on with the opening parade and the street events where there's judging that takes place and that sort of thing. So maybe an interesting question would be, why don't they do it again?
Right?
So it happened once. The settler population was very pleased with it.
Uh-huh.
But it doesn't happen a second time. Mm. And I don't have a good answer for that.
Mm.
But that in itself could be an act of agency, for all we know.
Right?
Like, maybe they were like, this is a bit off. But I can't say.
Right. I mean, it's one thing to play a bad guy, right? But it's another thing to play a bad guy, but then be told that your real life is also as a bad guy. If you know what I mean?
Like, absolutely.
Like
it's one,
you know, you go on stage or you do this raid thing as, you know, I'm the bad guy, I'm kidnapping the mayor.
Yes.
But then to be put in an area on display and be told, or have the visitors told, you're primitive and all these other things, then maybe that sort of goes too far.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? And then they say, well, no, we're not doing
that. We're not going to do that
again.
Yeah. Yeah. And I could see how that could happen, but I can't say for sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Was it possible that maybe the initial reaction that was positive sort of turned more negative from the press or the white population? They said, that was fun, but we don't need to see that again.
You know, it's really hard to say because that type of source I haven't found, if it exists. It could exist. And I haven't seen Well, here's another possibility that I haven't found, but yeah. It could be.
Sure.
The federal government was very keen not to have First Nations peoples represented as uncivilized.
Right?
What they really wanted, and this is something that I would like to look into more, because at the Stampede, there were exhibitions of schoolwork or handicraft that the federal government supported, because this is what they wanted the public to see in terms of, look at what is happening in this First Nations population in terms of, quote unquote, quote, taking an uncivilized population and civilizing them, right?
Yeah.
So it's quite possible that after this little stunt, the Indian agents are like, this is not the type of representation that we want to support. Mm-hmm. And there could have been some negotiation there between the organizers and the Indian agents, as there often was, in terms of what type of representation could happen.
Right, because if the federal government is funding a lot of this stuff, that they would want to make sure that the narrative that they present about First Nations is accurately reflected.
That's right. And they felt they had this long-term investment in trying to reshape an entire population.
Right.
And so if you start, or if you continue on certain narratives, then those changes, it looks like they're not happening. Right.
Yeah.
So it makes them look bad.
Right, because the whole policy is about assimilation.
That's right.
And if you're saying, well, these groups are primitive and living an unassimilated life, that challenges
absolutely
with the official government policy.
It's true. And the other interesting thing about who gets to participate in the Stampede, according to the federal government, is usually elderly men, which adds a whole other layer of this idea that First Nations people are dying off and are of the past and are archaic, because most of the participants are individuals who could leave the reserve during an agricultural time.
Right?
So they tried to keep the younger men on the reserve farming and allowed the older men, in the early days at least.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and for an event like this, the raid, for instance, that could also be a decision made based on the fact that a younger, stronger man could be seen as an actual physical threat.
Yeah, that's right. More threatening, absolutely. Yeah. Other than, instead of, you know, Chief Weasel Calf, who's 90 years old.
Right. Right. I think, most people would think that, you know, he's not overly dangerous.
No, that's right. That's right.
And I guess the other question is that, I mean, what about First Nations women?
Right.
We talked about the Stampede Princess?
Yeah, that's right.
You talked about that. But, I mean, say in the raid, do women have a role in this?
No, they do not. That's right. Again, that's a really easy answer. They absolutely don't. And there's also something to this fear around white masculinity. Mm-hmm. So it's meaningful that they are going to a bureaucratic establishment such as City Hall, where there's a lot of clerks who are not getting the physical, manly activity that people were doing, you know, prior to like the end of the 19th and early 20th century.
Like flipping hay bales.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Building stuff.
Chopping down trees.
Exactly.
Right. So there's also that anxiety around white masculinity and this loss of manliness.
Right.
So to stage something like this, it kind of reasserts that, oh yeah, there's still manly men around. Mm-hmm. A lot of the imagery around this period, when it comes to the Stampede and First Nations representation, are men. And they're masculine, and they are buff, and they usually have at least a knife, if not a bow and arrow. Mm-hmm. Like, so this idea of mastery over the land. So even though Calgary has been built as mastery over the land, it's different than the masculinity that's supposed to reside within First Nations men.
Let's be honest, the traditional view of the West is a very masculine place.
Totally.
Right?
Yep.
And like in Hollywood representations of the West,
that's right.
Women are there as prizes, really.
Mostly, yeah.
And
yep.
So they don't really have a place in this world that dominated by violence and uncertainty and untamed lands.
That's right.
Like the traditional notions of femininity aren't represented in the West.
No.
So in this situation, that it's not surprising.
No.
That women would not be included.
That's right. And when you think about the way First Nations women are racialized, it is in an incredibly negative way, right? So one thing that happens with Evelyn Eaglespeaker is that she is always the Indian princess, even though there are contests where, and I don't want to use the word, but the S word that really has had such a negative connotation around prostitution and First Nations women's sexuality.
Right.
But that word was used in other areas in the Stampede, but never with her. So there's also that aspect of not just kind of traditional white femininity, but the sexualization of First Nations women.
Right.
Yeah.
Which comes back, too, to issues of masculinity, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? And sort of the domination of a masculine view of the world, right?
That's
And the ability to take advantage of female sexuality is part of that.
Exactly,
And, you know, for as wrong as that is from a moral or just an ethical standpoint, I mean, that's that has existed for a long time.
Absolutely. And that would have been, you know, part and parcel. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So does this event and sort of your research overall, does that change the way that we should look at Stampede? Like, you say that there's still an Indian village at Stampede.
It's true.
Like, do we need to be more critical of it? I mean, I think particularly in the East, we look at it as, oh, that's kind of fun. They're riding horses and riding, like, okay, fine. And they have fun. But, and there's pancakes.
Just many pancakes,
But do we need to look at it more critically and think that, well, that maybe there's been a detrimental legacy to this part of the Stampede that maybe we need to be more critical of the event as a whole?
I think so. I would like that to come personally out of the First Nations community.
Sure.
I think that would be awesome. And right now, the way the Indian village has changed is that it's really become a cultural center, right? So they actually have interpreters there that you can ask questions.
Right.
The language has been maintained, even to the point where throughout the 20th century, there would be certain teepees that would be open to inspection, and it was in part for them to be judged because there were prizes given out.
Right.
But that language is still, or at least was still used when I was there a few years ago, that, you know, a certain teepee would be open to inspection. And as a individual of a settler family, that was very unsettling for me.
Right.
So I was like, that is not how, in my mind, I want to interact with this space and these individuals, right?
Right, yeah. And that note, even just the word inspection, there's a lot of meaning to that.
The surveillance, right? And or at least that's what comes to my mind when I think of that. But like I said, the families and the people that I talked to were very proud that they had been able to participate in this way.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, like most colonial things, it's very complicated.
Sure.
So it would be fantastic, I think, for that community to start to, you know, say this is kind of the legacy and it ties into some of the other issues around colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That issue that you point out, that it can't really come from, like, if you're bothered by it, then okay, you're bothered by
that's
it.
That's right.
But if they're not bothered by it,
right,
and they have this agency in it, and they're actively changing what's going on, and it gives an opportunity to assert their view, their voice.
That's right.
I mean, who the hell are we to say anything about it?
Well, that's what the difficulty is, right?
Yeah.
So the reason my kind of overall study ends in 1970 is, so the white paper comes out in 67, I think, and then there's a response, which is the red paper, and that comes out of the Indian Association of Alberta.
Mm.
And then that's where you're starting to see a change in the Stampede, even, where they start giving more control over to First Nations people in terms of organizing their events and performance. And they actually have at least one First Nations judge for these kind of events and stuff.
Right.
So that's when people are kind of starting to let go and starting to see that, well, maybe this is slightly problematic the way we've been doing this. So that's when things start to change.
Right, and it's something that happens with all marginalized groups.
Yeah.
Like if you just look at like the criticism of the movie Lincoln,
like
this notion that, oh, it's this white guy who comes in and saves all these slaves.
Sure.
And it completely discounts 200 or 300 years of resistance.
Absolutely.
To slavery, right? Like,
yeah.
it's this notion of someone from a colonial background saving people from colonialism, right? It really is a complicated issue.
It is, and it takes a lot of time. Hmm. I mean, the 20th century isn't that long ago, and even 1923 isn't that long ago,
sure.
Like, when you think about it, mm-hmm. in terms of time.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it does take a really long time for attitudes and opinions to change, right? And a lot of that goes unseen.
Mm-hmm.
It's the small steps.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden, Lincoln comes.
Yeah.
It's just like, done.
We did it.
Yeah,
good job, everybody.
It's like these musicians who win, Best New Artist, and they've been new for the last 15 years of their lives.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, they've been playing shows since they were 15 years old.
Exactly.
And
then all of a sudden, they're new, and they're like, well, this has been my career for 15 years.
And with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission stuff, has pointed this out, too, that these things are small, incremental, and, the long-term effects of this are going to be noticeable probably well after we're gone.
Absolutely.
And it's but in the interim, let's be nice to each other.
That's
let's
right.
take
what
steps.
Can we do?
Right.
Yeah,
what can we
right.
do on an individual basis, on a day-to-day basis,
exactly,
to make things better? And
that's right, and
those are the sort of lessons that are learned from this sort of stuff.
Absolutely. I think my happiest moment in my research was I was giving my mom stuff to read, and she was a teacher, but she doesn't have any background in kind of post-colonial theory or anything else. And at the end, she was like, I didn't realize this history existed. Like, we were never taught any of these things in school. And she felt like she had a better handle on maybe some of the current issues, political issues around First Nationsness and Aboriginality and the state. And I was like, my job's dead then. Well, maybe not so much, but yeah.
You got one.
Like,
you got one.
That's right. So we can kind of like chip away.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So, one mom at a time.
So this project, what's sort of next? I mean, you're looking at the Stampede stuff. And, so are we going to look at it further? Like, what do you hope to come of this?
I'm actually working on the kind of overall manuscript for a book.
Right.
And then I'm very interested out of this at looking at kind of more of the First Nations handicraft projects. So staying within the realm of First Nations, but popular culture.
Right.
So the types of handicrafts that would have been sold right across the country, which a lot of that was actually orchestrated by the federal government.
Nice.
Yes.
Right.
So again.
Right. And similar questions of authenticity and those sort of things that come up with that.
That's right. What are white expectations around what an actual First Nations handicraft is, which might be very different than what a cultural expectation would be,
So. Well, it's really interesting stuff and important stuff. And as we say, the talk here was Captive Audience, the 1923 Raid on Calgary City Hall, and the dissertation looks at representations of First Nations at Stampede between 1912 and 1970. And we'll look forward to a book.
Thanks.
In the future.
Thank you.
So, Susan Jodry, St. Mary's University, thank you very much for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
If you have any questions or comments for the podcast, it's historyslam@gmail.com. Twitter is @DrShawneeFever. And if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Be sure to check out Active History for more features, articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.